From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Amid the calls for student-athletes to retain the first part of their hyphenation, a brigade of senior citizens is cracking the whip and keeping University of Kansas kids in the classroom. That story is just ahead on Only a Game. Also, the San Diego State Aztecs run up the NCAA rankings and a profile of Kendra Stern, the Division III swimmer with Division I time. Also ahead, a legendary Hollywood stuntman discusses the dangers of his profession.
I went 620 miles an hour. My braking parachutes didn't work, and I crashed off the end of the dry lake at 350, and I said, you know, somebody could really get hurt bad doing this.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Lakers may not be as washed up as some people thought. The Spurs have kicked things into gear, and they may not get caught. The Knicks are looking better than they have in recent years, which can't be said of Cleveland's hapless, hopeless Cavaliers. Joining me now to evaluate those conclusions and discuss other NBA matters is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
The Cleveland Cavaliers lost to Dallas on Monday, thus setting the record for longest NBA losing streak at 25 games. The previous record was held, fittingly, by the 1981-1982 Cavaliers. Then Cleveland lost Wednesday to Detroit, but amazingly, they beat the Clippers last night. So the streak ended at 26 losses in a row. Does the next record-breaking losing streak begin tomorrow against Washington?
Might. The Cavaliers broke their own record of futility, but if there's a franchise that can match the Cavaliers for futility, it's the LA Clippers, although I would say the Clippers' future slightly brighter than the poor Cavaliers. LeBron James, in much the same way that Ted Thompson was vindicated turning to young Aaron Rodgers, I think LeBron James has been vindicated in leaving woebegone Cleveland.
You know, regarding the Cavaliers and all this losing, teams in the NBA have been known to tank in order to get a better shot in the lottery. I wonder if the Cavaliers even have to try to tank.
No, that's one thing they've got taken care of, totally taken care of by that roster. You cannot impugn their integrity. They are losing honestly and atrociously.
Is it safe to say that the Miami Heat has found its stride?
Absolutely, and I see a team that is so athletic, a team that can get good shots with 5 seconds on the shot clock, and the Heat can always put the ball in Dwayne Wade's hands or LeBron James's hands and get a decent shot. I think the Heat, clearly the favorites to come out of the East, and I'm not backing off my year-long prediction of Heat over the Lakers in the finals.
When Boston and L.A. meet during the regular season, people often talk about it as a statement game. What, if any, statement was made on Thursday when the visiting Lakers beat the Celtics 92-86?
Well, there were a couple statements made in that game. The obvious one was Ray Allen setting the NBA's all-time three-point field goal record. That means two things. That means you're a great shooter. It also means you're old, unfortunately, because you don't set those career marks when you're 25. And I think that the Celtics got exposed for their age a little bit against the Lakers on Thursday night. It gets harder in May. It gets harder in June. And I just don't see how this particular unit of the Celtics can compete in a seven-game series with those young, athletic Miami Heat.
Kevin, the Knicks are playing at about a 500 pace this season, which is a vast improvement over recent years. Much has been said about how important it is to the NBA for the Knicks to be good, but hasn't the league been doing okay even during those years when the Knicks were terrible?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly the Knicks at least are entertaining now, and if they were, I don't think they would be a title contender if they got Carmelo Anthony, but they certainly would be that much more entertaining.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Carmelo Anthony in that context. Carmelo Anthony was going to be a Knick, and then he was going to be a Net, and then for a little while he was going to be a Laker, and now he's saying he'll consider signing an extension with Denver if he isn't dealt by the February 24th deadline. What's your guess about where he ends up?
I think he's still going to find his way to New York. I think that's where he wants to be, and often these things have a way. I mean, especially when you start getting third and fourth teams involved, they have a way of accommodating the superstar. The one thing, you know, while it was briefly rumored out here that Carmelo might be coming to the Lakers, I thought, you know, how would that work? And one thing I will say about Kobe Bryant, he hates to lose. I mean, you see it on his face. You see it every twitch. Like, he hates to lose. He hates to lose any possession. He hates to lose. And watching the Nuggets and watching Carmelo Anthony, I feel like he's okay with losing. He'd rather win. He'd rather win, but I don't think he loses a lot of sleep at night.
San Antonio has rather quietly posted the league's best record, so I guess it speaks softly and carry a big Duncan.
I'm not backing off my year-long statement that that team is too old, that the big three, that Duncan, Ginobili, and Parker cannot get them to the promised land. But my convictions are being tested as they storm towards 68 wins. It's a testament to Popovich and the way they play every night. And, you know, they just won a very tough game by one point on a tip-in at the buzzer against the Lakers out here in L.A., and they do look playoff ready. They look playoff tough. But I'm not going to deviate. I still don't think that team can beat the Lakers in a 7-game playoff series.
Kevin, on Thursday, Utah head coach Jerry Sloan announced his retirement. He's been with the team since 1988 and recently signed a 1-year extension with the Jazz. Were you as surprised as everybody else seemed to be when he decided to hang it up?
Not really. I mean, you know, I think it was time. I think there was some burnout there and definitely some disconnect with the players, most notably Deron Williams. And I think they can't say that they didn't give Jerry Sloan's system the best shot. You know, 23 seasons, a lot of wins, no championships, and Deron Williams is a superstar. Now it's on him. You know, were you being held back by Jerry Sloan? Well, we're about to find out because it's your team now, Deron Williams. And I feel like we'll see if he's good enough to take them to that next level, because right now I don't even have them in the top four in the West.
Kevin Hench covers the NBA for FoxSports.com. You can hear his podcast with John Sally, Spider and the Henchman on iTunes and AdamCarolla.com. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Bill.
In San Diego, the baseball Padres and the football Chargers dominate sports headlines, but this year a college sports program is winning over the locals. The San Diego State Aztecs are the 6th-ranked men's basketball team in the country. From member station KPBS in San Diego, Eric Anderson has the story.
Viejas Arena is nearly full on this cool December night. The green uniforms of the Cal Poly team are out of place in that sea of red and black. The student section leads the show. They cheer, they boo, they make the game as difficult as possible for the visitors. It's a far cry from the days when the arena opened in 1997. Then, the basketball team was only drawing about 1,500 fans a game. Losing in 14 of the previous 16 seasons will do that. This year, the 12,000-seat facility has sold out for nearly every home game. Longtime fan Gilbert Fembris says he's watched the change and he welcomes his fellow fans.
Now that they're a top 10 team, regardless of whether they're playing mediocre teams, people are still coming out because it's fun to watch and it's a bargain.
Due in part to the $10 to $20 ticket prices, the turnstiles are getting a workout this year. Before the season, there were only 8 sellouts in 15 years. San Diego State's season began with 20 straight wins and a national ranking that peaked at number 4. The national spotlight is focused on San Diego, in large part because of the head coach, who came here 12 years ago. Steve Fisher landed in San Diego after an uncomfortable departure from Michigan. He won a national championship with the Wolverines in 1989, but rumblings about a booster's ties to a star player got him fired in 1997. He took a year off, spent a year in professional basketball, and then arrived in San Diego. Fisher's first team here only won 5 games, and he dismissed half the squad after the season. The coach wanted quality players capable of competing. The strategy began paying dividends, and the team qualified for the NCAA tournament in 2002. For Fisher, it was a lesson in geographic expectations.
When we went to the tournament our first year, I said I could be elected mayor here. If you just make the tournament back in Michigan, they're going to fire you.
The athletic department's Mike May says running with the blue bloods of college basketball is new for the Aztecs, and the top 5 ranking makes this season even sweeter.
Now when you have a special season, you can kind of peek into that rarefied air where you're mentioned with Duke and Kansas and Syracuse and Connecticut and those types of programs.
The expectations may be different now, but Fisher's recipe for success is the same. Find athletic, talented basketball players, teach them how to work together, and play stifling defense. 6'8" senior forward Billy White listens to his coach because Fisher has already been at the top.
He always tells us, you know, don't let this get to our heads. Stay humble. If you guys want to stay like this, you guys are going to keep winning. In order to win, you got to put hard in work and practice.
Put some effort into it, man. Put some energy into it. Let's go. Go get the ball.
Fisher stands at half court in Viejas Arena, arms crossed, watching his players run through their drills. Darkness shrouds the stands that rise up around the court. Fisher's practice is a mix of tempo and teaching. Players go full bore 1 minute, then get a lesson the next.
You got to hit him, BC. You can't let that ball come over your head.
Good job, Billy. I'll let it.
Find Hutt. Find Hutt right away. Get up. Find Hutt. Come on, move it.
6'11" Brian Carwell jostles for position with 6'9" Malcolm Thomas. Thomas wrestles a rebound from his teammate and fires the ball up court. Fisher's eyes are on everything, and his tongue can be quick and biting at practice. Thomas says coach is different during a game.
He's been there. He knows what to expect. And, you know, he never loses his cool. He's always calm. And that helps us on the court.
Fisher says he wants the team to enjoy its accomplishments on the court and off. He knows how difficult it is to achieve. And he knows this season is still a work in progress.
We still never won an NCAA tournament game. So that's one of our goals, to get into the tournament and then win in the tournament. We've gotten in 3 times before and have gotten knocked out the first round.
Last year, a terrible first half against Tennessee cost them that first tournament win. But Fisher was already talking about this year after that close loss. The NCAA tournament is just over a month away. Fisher is one of 11 active coaches who've won a national championship. And with a birthday coming up, the 65-year-old coach has an idea about a gift.
March 24th, I want to be playing on my birthday. So if we're doing that, we'll be in pretty good shape.
San Diego State plays UNLV tonight in Las Vegas. For Only a Game, I'm Eric Anderson in San Diego.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. On Sunday, contestants from all over Japan gathered in a campground near Tokyo to compete for a top prize of 100,000 yen, a little over $1,200. Armed with shovels and dressed in flamboyant costumes, over 200 teams made up of men, women, and children dug the deepest holes they could manage in 30 minutes. Amateur diggers labored alongside the pros, men who dig on behalf of the gas company every day. The contest included rules, of course. Competitors who threw dirt into somebody else's hole risked disqualification, and creative holes garnered extra points. This year's winners dug to a depth of 10 feet 8 inches. Fine. Now, can somebody tell me what constitutes a creative hole?
I dig a hole in a meadow. I dig a hole in a cold, cold ground. I dig a hole.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a Division III swimmer with Division I times. But first, some colleges take the phrase student-athlete more seriously than others do. A program recently introduced at the University of Kansas suggests that athletes who are thinking about skipping class there better get used to being watched by Big Brother, or at least by old guys. The university has hired senior citizens to make sure the athletes are remembering to be students. Hannah Karp has written about the program for the Wall Street Journal, and she joins me now on the phone from New York. Hannah, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much.
Lots of colleges and universities hire students to monitor the academic behavior of student athletes. Kansas used to do that, too. Why did they switch to senior citizen monitors?
Well, they started to notice that not all of their reports were adding up. They might cross-check them with some professors, and they started to realize that some of the students weren't going to class either and were just marking all the athletes down, or, you know, the athletes would ask them, hey, let me slide, you know, and because these guys are pretty popular on campus, it was sort of an easy sell. So one of the associate athletic directors decided to bring in a retired police officer who had also been in the Marine Corps.
Whoa.
So he was pretty tough. He's now in his 70s, and he leads a community workout, actually, a sort of boot camp in Lawrence, Kansas, and he started recruiting some of his older friends that had retired and didn't have much else to do. This is a great job for them because they get to walk all around campus and get some exercise and feel like they're doing something important, which they are. And so then when he brought in some helpers, they started really monitoring their student checkers, and they found out that they really were unreliable on the whole, so they did away with student checkers altogether.
So the senior citizens are less susceptible to student athletes saying, hey, I'll toss you a couple of tickets if you don't mention that I'm not going to class.
Yeah, that's what they say. They actually do get an allotment of tickets for every game to prevent that.
Now, who are these seniors beyond being members of a fitness class? Are they volunteers, or they get paid, or what? How does that work?
They do get paid. It's not a whole lot of money. I think they do it more for fun, but they do get paid. They have a range of careers. One was a retired PE teacher, one was a retired truck driver, one used to be a child psychologist. It really runs the gamut.
So I take it that this program is working pretty well.
It seems to be, yeah. Kansas has one of the highest academic success rates in the country, so they are doing relatively well. Maryland, though, they still believe in their student checkers, and when I spoke with one of the associate athletic directors there, she mentioned that she might not trust senior citizens with the task because they are some of Maryland's most rabid fans.
They'd be the ones who'd let the athlete slide if there was an
yeah.
eligibility problem. Well, the program in Kansas is meant to ensure that all of KU's student athletes attend class, but the Jayhawks are the nation's number two men's basketball team. If a monitor reports that a basketball player has not been showing up for class, what happens in the way of punishment?
I think the punishment varies. It really is on a case-by-case basis. I think eventually, if it's too big of a problem, the athlete's suspended for a certain amount of time. But it's really on a case-by-case basis, and not everyone gets checked on. It's only the athletes that are identified as being at risk. Usually it's more freshmen than seniors.
Well, I understand that on at least one occasion, a professor has not responded positively to a mysterious old man lurking in the hall and peeking through his classroom window.
Right. When they first started the program, you know, they didn't put out a memo, so it was a shock to some of the professors who were noticing these people just peering in through the windows and kind of hanging out. I mean, security is a big issue these days.
Sure.
So one professor called her husband in a panic because she noticed a stranger outside. But now I think everyone's pretty used to these checkers, and they're not really supposed to come inside the classroom, so they're not too much of a nuisance.
But I gather from your article that the reason that they not only check whether students come into class but also look through the windows is they want to make sure the students remain awake in class.
Yeah, that was another problem they were noticing with the student checkers. I mean, it's easy to just make sure the students are going into the classroom, but then when the elderly ones first started, they would check them in and then, you know, see the same student on campus somewhere else, you know, 20 minutes later. So they realized they needed to improve their system. So now they do sign-ins at the door, and then they sort of prowl around the halls, you know, making sure that no one's trying to escape.
So that would explain the reference in your article to the jailbreak.
Yes. It's not exactly jail, but one class checker told me a story of signing someone in and then he was in the hallway and he saw the player walking out with his coat, and the player looked at him and froze and then asked him, "Can you hold my jacket while I go to the bathroom?"
I just love the idea of a 6'9" basketball player freezing at the sight of a little old man who's checking on him.
Well, they take it very seriously, so I might be scared too.
Yeah. Have you any evidence that the employment of senior citizens to monitor the behavior of student athletes is likely to catch on anywhere else?
Schools do spend quite a lot of money on these programs. I mean, some schools spend tens of thousands of dollars a year paying students to check on athletes. So I think it's an investment that schools take seriously. And if they find out that their students aren't being as responsible as they'd like, I think this is a solution that might catch on.
Hannah Karp's story, Making Sure Athletes Go to Class, appeared in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal. Hannah, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
Amherst College swimmer Kendra Stern's time in the 200-meter freestyle at last year's NCAA championships was good enough for eighth place in Division I and All-American status. The only problem is that Stern did it at the Division III championships. Only a game's Doug Tribou reports.
It's the last Saturday in January, senior day for the swimmers at Amherst College. Today's matchup against the Massachusetts Institute of Technology is the class of 2011's final meet in the small western Massachusetts town of Amherst. And the 500-meter freestyle is Kendra Stern's last individual event at Pratt Pool. "500 meters is 20 lengths of the pool. Stern takes the lead immediately. By the second half of the race, the only time other swimmers are near her, they're headed in the opposite direction because Stern has already lapped them. When she taps the wall in just over 4 minutes 51 seconds, Stern has obliterated her own pool record by more than 3 seconds. Stern puts her goggles up on her head, checks the scoreboard, shakes hands with an MIT swimmer in the next lane, and hops out of the pool. No pump of the fist, no slap of the water, not even much of a smile. Kendra Stern does not like celebrating.
I've always just had this thing like once you touch the wall, the race is over and there's nothing that you can do about it. And I don't want to say like it's because I'm uncomfortable by like the win, because like obviously I'm excited to have won, but at the same time I think that I try to play it down, and that's not always the best thing. I think that people like to see me get excited.
And Stern has had plenty of exciting moments. She holds 5 individual school records and was part of all 5 of Amherst's relay records. 3 of her Amherst bests are also national Division III marks. She's won 10 national titles at the NCAA D3 championships. Meanwhile, Stern is a double major, art history and Spanish, at one of the country's top academic colleges. Amherst men's and women's swimming coach Nick Nichols says swimming and school get equal billing in Kendra's life.
You're here obviously to talk about swimming, but if you're here to talk about art history, you'd never know she was a swimmer. You could. There are professors who, when I mention the name, oh, is she? You know, is she on the team? And I just, you know, I don't think she would tell you that she's a swimmer.
In the latest College Swimming Coaches Association of America poll, the MIT women's team is ranked 6th in the nation. The Amherst Lord Jeffs are number 8. MIT women's and men's head coach Dawn Dill says even in a meet between top Division III programs, Kendra Stern is in a class of her own.
You know, at NCAA, she could probably win any event from the 50 to the mile. She'd also place top 3 in just about any other event, the IM, the 100 fly. She could be a finalist for any Division I powerhouse, and the fact that she's really developed here at Amherst College under Nick's tutelage has been just fun to watch.
Stern grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and her parents, Mimi and Walter, are in town for Senior Day. They're wearing T-shirts made for the occasion with a picture of Kendra as a small child leaping into a pool. Mimi Stern says smaller schools appealed to Kendra.
After talking with other people who had been to D1 schools or participated in athletics at D1 schools, it seemed as though the swimming aspects were basically a full-time job. and to be able to do other things and actually have a life and the opportunity to pursue outside interests at your whim seemed to be much more comfortably handled at the D3 school.
Kendra's final two choices were Amherst and nearby rival Williams College, but there was a complicating factor. Her older sister Megan was already a student and swimmer at Amherst. In the end, Kendra decided to join her on the Lord Jeff's team. The sisters still share relay records, but Kendra quickly eclipsed Megan's individual marks, something coach Nick Nichols wasn't expecting after Kendra's first campus visit.
And Megan had already had quite a bit of success here, and she said, you want my sister to come to school here, she's going to be really good. And I watched her swim, but I can remember looking and thinking, yeah, she looks like she might be okay. And I don't want to say it might have been the biggest mistake I've ever made, but I'd love to say I saw the potential from the beginning, but I really honestly can't say that.
Unlike many collegiate swimmers, Stern didn't focus on the sport exclusively until high school. When she got into Amherst's training program, her time started falling fast. As a freshman, she won 3 individual national titles and 3 more in relays. Fellow senior and men's co-captain Ryan Colby says Amherst's practices are co-ed, and Kendra often ends up working out in the guys' side of the pool.
When I was a freshman, Nick told me sooner or later I was going to lose to a woman. I was going to lose in practice to a woman, which I didn't think was going to happen, but then the day happened, and I lost. And, I mean, at the time, I had qualified for NCAAs that year in the 500 free. But if Kendra's having a good day and you're having a mediocre day, you better man up because you're going to get run over.
Stern's accomplishments make her a leader on the team, but she says it's a role that doesn't come naturally.
I'm not like the first person to, you know, make a big speech before the meet or to say anything really, so I'd rather cultivate relationships with a few people and leave my mark that way.
Amherst sophomore Emily Sweat says even without speeches, Stern's leadership is strong, and it showed during a recent training session.
She would come back from practice, and before you knew it, she was going out on a run. It's incredible to see the lengths that she's willing to go to reach her goals, and I think that that is definitely contagious.
In the closing event, Stern anchors the 400 free relay. Amherst wins the race and the meet. Stern wins her 4th event of the day and comes one step closer to the end of her college career. What's next? Coach Nick Nichols says they've talked about training for another year for the Olympic trials.
I think that would be fun, but it's a bit more of a maybe a Division III attitude where I'm not going to push her, her parents aren't going to push her, and if she wants to take a shot at it, then we'll put a plan together. But I think she is that good that it's worth considering.
Kendra Stern does not enjoy talking about herself. During our conversation after the meet, her cheeks turn bright pink. She also doesn't like to get ahead of herself.
What's your ideal scenario?
For the end of this year?
Or no, for the end of your swimming.
For the end of my swimming? Oh, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I'm sorry.
Too far
it's
out?
It's a lot to think about, and I like to take things sort of like small steps at a time. If I look too far ahead, I freak myself out.
The Amherst women defeated Springfield College last weekend to close out their regular season at 7-1. Stern and her teammates are preparing for the New England Small College Athletic Conference Championships, which will be held at Williams College later this month. The NCAA Division III Championships in Knoxville, Tennessee, open March 23rd. And in case you're willing to look a little further ahead, the U.S. Olympic trials in Omaha, Nebraska, begin in June 2012. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
You're listening to Only a Game. On a couple of occasions, Only a Game has featured a couple of guys who call themselves the two Chinese characters. They've helped us with the pronunciation of words like Beijing. Alice Goldfarb emailed recently to say, I should have consulted the two Chinese characters before I referred to Australian Open finalist Li Na as Ms. Na. I guess I should have identified her as Ms. Li. Teresa Bowen, who hears the program courtesy of North Country Public Radio in New York, emailed to say she appreciates what she called the lighthearted humor of my conversations with Charlie Pierce, but Mark Illuminati wrote to correct rather than praise Charlie. In our pre-Super Bowl conversation, Charlie talked about how the Packers-Steelers matchup woke up the echoes of the NFL's earliest days. Mr. Illuminati illuminated us as follows. The Steelers didn't join the NFL until 1933, so they couldn't have been on the field with the founders of the league. Edward Montano of Whittier, California, emailed to say, if you are tired of the Super Bowl hype, stop doing stories that hype the Super Bowl. We have launched an investigation into the matter of Mr. Montano's loyalty to the nation. It certainly doesn't sound as if he's a real American. The 17th edition of Super Bowl Haiku in last week's program called forth an unprecedented hail of haiku. You can read lots of them at our website, and I'll present just a few here. One that turned out to be something of a favorite around the office goes like this. One question remains of Super Bowl XLV. Extra large V-neck? That came from Valerie Bach. Sarah Solnick tweeted us a haiku that I can't help but characterize as a sweet tweet. I don't love football or hockey or NASCAR, but I love OAG. A tweet so sweet it bears a repeat, but I'll resist the temptation. And finally, there's what might be considered the first candidate for inclusion in the 18th edition of Super Bowl Haiku. The 2012 extravaganza will take place in Indianapolis, which inspired Doug Johnson, who hears the program on WFYI in Indianapolis, to write, the Peyton guy says, next year for XLVI, y'all come to my house. You can contact us at onlyagame.org. You can also leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only A Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Run for your health. Or if you don't find that idea appealing, run for donuts. About 7,500 people did that at the annual Krispy Kreme Challenge in Raleigh, North Carolina last weekend. The rules of the challenge dictate that competitors must run for 2 miles, eat a dozen donuts at the Krispy Kreme store, and then run back to the starting line. The tradition was initiated by students at North Carolina State University 8 years ago, and it has since grown to the point where it generates more than $50,000 for the North Carolina Children's Hospital, which, one presumes, is equipped to treat people who've run 2 miles, eaten too many donuts, and then tried to run 2 more miles.
I love donuts. That's all I can say. I eat donuts at night and donuts in the day. I ate 95 donuts just last week. People be saying I'm some kind of freak. I eat donuts for breakfast, donuts for lunch.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Hal Needham, stuntman, athlete, and sucker for a pretty face. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
As are we all, Bill.
Yes, indeed. You maintained last week, as you do before each NFL championship, that the Super Bowl is good. I guess at least 400 people who held tickets to last Sunday's game would disagree.
Actually, they were very lucky because they could have all been shuffled into their ill-constructed seats and been injured by now. They could have very good seats in various Dallas area hospitals now. Yes, the Super Bowl is good. This particular Super Bowl had some real problems.
Charlie, the cliche has it that after you win the Super Bowl, you go to Disney World. I guess Clay Matthews of the Packers was reading from another script.
Yes, he went and became an unofficial character in a WWE drama in which he leaped into the ring as an alternate referee.
How shocking.
To make a three count.
The referees almost never get involved.
Well, the ones from the stands do a
lot. That's what I mean.
What were the odds that he would have a referee shirt with him, by the way?
This week's bargaining sessions between the NFL and the Players Association were scheduled to go long. They didn't. Was that a good sign or a bad sign?
That's a normal sign, because the NFL owners do not want a settlement except on every one of their terms, and they're not likely to get that. There are no real problems to fix in this game. This is just one side being really greedy and want to claw some money back. So, no, I'm not surprised at all when no solution is reached.
Well, just out of curiosity, how long before a solution is reached, and will there be football?
I suspect midway through next season is a pretty good bet.
Heisman winner Cam Newton worked out for the media on Thursday. The trial was in shorts, which I'm told means that it was meaningless. But can you explain why so many of the resulting stories suggest that Newton should not be a high draft pick?
Well, apparently he's got the wrong overhand delivery or something, and apparently because Jamarcus Russell didn't work out with Oakland, which is one I don't exactly understand. Perhaps he's a bit overrated given what his team accomplished. I would still take a chance on him.
Penguins captain Sidney Crosby says there's no guarantee that he will return from a concussion to play more hockey this season. Crosby has been out since January 5th after taking blows to the head in two games in a row. Bruins captain Mark Savard has already been ruled out for the season because of concussion problems he's had. Football gets most of the negative press for concussions, but maybe it's time to look a little more closely at hockey.
Well, I think hockey should have been looking a little closely at hockey. Eric Lindros should have been a dominant player of his era, and his career was cut short, as was that of his brother, by the way, because of post-concussion syndrome and chronic tendency to get concussions. I think you're going to be seeing a lot more concentration of this in hockey, and I think a lot more concentration on this in soccer.
In pro basketball news, Jerry Sloan, the longest tenured head coach in any of the four major sports, is walking away from the Utah Jazz. He is the only NBA coach to have won 1,000 games with one team. My favorite stat regarding Jerry Sloan is that the Los Angeles Clippers ran through 13 head coaches during his tenure with the Jazz.
Yeah, coaches simply do not hold on to jobs as long as Jerry Sloan hung on to his in Utah. He had, you know, the most, let's face it, unique fan base demographic to deal with. He had cheapskate owners. He had Karl Malone and John Stockton through the entire prime of their careers. And you could say he lucked into them, but he didn't luck into keeping them. He's a heck of a coach. I mean, he will be missed. This is a major story in the NBA.
On Thursday night, Celtics guard Ray Allen broke Reggie Miller's NBA record for career three-pointers. So, three cheers for the new three-point king.
Three cheers for he and for Reggie Miller, who was in attendance as part of the TNT broadcast crew, whose record Ray Allen broke. They had a lovely little ceremony by courtside after he'd done it. Ray Allen is everything you want in a professional athlete. Of course, the Celtics went on and lost the game.
Yeah, I was going to say, that would have been the better punchline.
Sort of bummed everyone out. But, yeah, this is a considerable record for him.
Barry Bonds is no longer facing 11 felony charges for perjury. This week, federal prosecutors cut that number to 5 charges. These indictments have been hanging over Bonds since 2007. Do you think this means prosecutors might soon move forward?
I have no idea. I do know it means that prosecutors are wondering about what kind of case they have. At a certain level, this has been a preposterous exercise since day one. We're still dealing with renegade drug agents and leaking prosecutions, and who knows what's going to complicate the trials they have left. I suspect the number of felony charges will be down to 1 or 2 sometime before they go to trial.
Am I the only one who thinks this is all playing out like a Monty Python skit? You have 11 felony charges.
No,
five. One misdemeanor.
Nobody expects a Spanish Inquisition.
Tom Hicks, former owner of the Texas Rangers, is also the former owner of Premiership Soccer Club Liverpool. Mr. Hicks is now claiming he was swindled by that club's directors when they forced him to sell it. He's looking for $1.6 billion in damages. You like his chances?
No, I don't, actually, because Tom Hicks is going to have to fight this one out in British courts, unfortunately, and I like the home field advantage there.
One reason to opt out of blood boosting, if you're a competitive cyclist, is that you might get caught and get suspended. This week, Italian pro cyclist Riccardo Ricco provided another reason to stay clean.
The blood he used to give himself a transfusion had gone bad, and he's very, very ill right now.
Giving oneself a transfusion just seems like a bad idea, whether you're an athlete or not.
Well, I think you should hire someone to give you. Blood doping is one of these things, you know, hey, it's your blood. Do what you want with it. Of course, the anti-doping people are now crying crocodile tears about poor Riccardo Ricco and what this proves about the nature of their phony baloney jobs. But I think you should really hire professionals to give yourself a blood transfusion.
I did not know until this week that the sport of curling is big in Nebraska. Undeniable proof, about 80 proof of that, emerged in Valentine, Nebraska this week when Jordan's Bar in Valentine began installing a curling rink. So how can I resist asking what could possibly go wrong?
Apparently nothing has gone wrong so far. The folks were hanging around Jordan's Bar in Valentine, Nebraska in the winter watching the Olympics. It was probably a blizzard outside. And they said, hey, that looks like fun. So they put up a sheet of ice outside, and now instead of using the stones, they use milk jugs, which obviously, this being Western Nebraska, were just sort of hanging around, filled with cement, and now they curl outside Jordan's Bar. I will pay Jordan's Bar up to $20 if they don't allow anybody from ESPN to come to their bar and film this and just keep it as a nice barroom sport. But I don't like my chances.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and several other books. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You may not know the name Hal Needham, but if you've watched a movie within which somebody jumps a car over a river, leaps from a helicopter onto a moving train, or flees an accident while engulfed in flames, you're familiar with his work. That's why Hal Needham's autobiography is titled Stuntman, My Car-Crashing, Plane-Jumping, Bone-Breaking, Death-Defying Hollywood Life. Hal Needham joins me now from NPR West in Los Angeles. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
What inspires somebody to want to be a stuntman as opposed to being a movie star?
Probably talent.
Oh, I love it. A one-word answer.
Well, no, I mean, I had the ability to be a stuntman, but to be an actor would be a whole different kettle of fish, you know? And I knew also that if I got in and if I were halfway successful, that I should do pretty good at it because I was always physical and agile and everything. So it was a choice I made.
You stopped doing stunts and took up directing movies and various other activities some years ago. But is there one stunt that even now causes you to wake up at night in a cold sweat?
Not really. No, I mean, I've had some close calls, but as long as I came out unscathed on the other side, I figured I'd successfully done the job.
How important is it for a stuntman to be a good athlete?
Oh, you can't do stunts without being an athlete. Being an athlete is really, really important. And the better athlete you are, the better stuntman you're going to be.
Is it fair to say that stuntmen and pro athletes also have in common a reluctance to tell their employers that they're injured?
Oh, especially in the picture business. Now, if you have a reputation for getting hurt every time you do a stunt and put in a claim and all that kind of stuff, you're not going to get any calls. Man, I've worked with broken collarbones and ribs and all kinds of things just to keep that from happening.
You crashed cars, you blew up trucks, you jumped from balconies before the production of special effects for the movies became digital. Do today's movies still call for courageous, albeit sometimes foolhardy stuntmen, or is everything, all the danger, computer-generated now?
Well, they still require quite a number of stuntmen, but computer-generated stuff to me is just boring. It's not realistic. You see them do things, you just say, there's no man on, Superman couldn't do that, for crying out loud, you know? And so when you lose the realism and the believability of it, they've lost me.
We often discuss record-setting achievements on Only a Game. Tell us about how you helped shatter the sound barrier with a car equipped with a rocket.
I drove it first, and I went 620 miles an hour. My braking parachutes didn't work, and I crashed off the end of the dry lake at 350, and I said, you know, somebody could really get hurt bad doing this. So I got So I got somebody else, a little younger and maybe a little dumber, and we went out different places, and we wound up at Edwards Air Force Base. We ran the car. We had 48,000 horsepower that developed in 5 milliseconds, all right? It went from zero. That thing went 142 miles an hour the first second. But we could only run about 714 miles an hour with that, so we needed more power. I met General Chuck Yeager over in the Philippines doing a film for the Air Force, and he said, well, you know, what you need is a Sidewinder missile. And I said, oh, big deal. Yeah, I'll just run down to the hardware store and buy some. He arranged for me to buy 6 Sidewinder missiles from the Navy, without their warheads, of course. And that's the way we broke the sound barrier. We strapped one on that thing, and the kid that was driving was Stan Barrett. And when he reached the 2.5 mile marker, he was doing about 700 miles an hour, and he hit that Sidewinder missile that had 12,000 horsepower, and it was enough to put him through the sound barrier.
Helping to establish a NASCAR team in 1981 must have seemed pretty tame after the rocket car adventure, because they don't allow rockets on NASCAR cars. Tell us a little bit about what attracted you to that challenge.
Well, they don't allow them, but I was thinking them a whole bunch about putting one on. They wouldn't let me. But I had raced some out on the West Coast here myself for 4 or 5 years. And I did it like everything else. I sat back and looked at it and said, well, you know what? Here's what I need to do. For instance, I needed PR. I hired an actor, 6'2", a black actor out of Atlanta, Georgia. He was a Shakespearean actor, okay? I put him in a high hat and tux and tails and things, and I walked him down through the garage area. I told the voodoo doctor, I said, okay, I'll move up to a car. You walk about 6 feet behind me, and when I get to a car, I'll stop. You just walk up and stare at that car. And that was going to be the 2 competitors I had. Well, damn. Next thing I know, NASCAR, the sanctioning body, they're on the microphone saying, Hal Needham, come to the NASCAR trailer. But I tell you what, those people down there went crazy. They went crazy.
Well, we talked about your breaking the sound barrier with a rocket car, and you also established the record for being the highest-paid stuntman. Beyond that, you may have set another record, although the circumstances probably aren't recorded in any book but your own. Has anybody else ever been robbed of his watch by the same gang of women more often than you have?
That doesn't... bode too good for me being too smart, does it?
You better tell us about it.
Well, all right. I met a lady in a bar. We were down in wherever at a race. I met a lady in a bar, and we decided to carry the conversation up to my room. Got there. Oh, on the way up, I took some drinks with me. So I got up the room. I'd been out the track all day. I said, I'm going to shower. While I was in the shower, I heard this humongous crash. I came out. I said, what happened? She said, oh, I dropped the drink tray. And I said, oh, no problem. We'll just order some more. She said, well, here, this is my drink, and I didn't spill it. And you drink it while I shower up. And I said, okay. I lay down on the bed, drank that. That's the last thing I remember till 6 o'clock next morning when my crew chief is calling me saying, where the hell are you, Hal? That lady took my Rolex, and she took my money and my rings. And you know what really made me angry? She even took my Louis Vuitton shaving kit bag to carry all of her loot in. That really made me angry. Anyway, a year later, same bar, different lady. And you know something? That lady must have had the same potion that the other one did, because next thing I knew, it was 6 in the morning. I get back to Hollywood, and my producer, I told him what happened. He gave me a Movado. Do you ever see a Movado? That's the biggest hunk of gold I ever had on my wrist in my life. He gave me that just so I wouldn't be late getting to the set. At the end of the season, I threw a big party for my racing crew. Mm-hmm. We're at this club. A real good-looking lady walked by, and I said to my driver, Harry Gann, I said, I think I'll ask her to dance. He said, let me hold your watch. That's all he said to me.
Hal Needham has worked in over 4,500 TV episodes and 310 feature films. He owned a rocket car until he gave it to the Smithsonian. He's broken 56 bones and his back twice. His book is Stuntman, My Car-Crashing, Plane-Jumping, Bone-Breaking, Death-Defying Hollywood Life. It's published by Little Brown, and the author spoke to me from Los Angeles. Mr. Needham, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, you know what? This has been the most fun I've had in a long time. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Mark Filippino. We had help from Leo Dell'Aguila. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from stuntman Hal Needham.
Oh, you know what? It's fun if it works out. If it doesn't work out, it ain't too much fun.
I think Hal was talking about jumping out of an airplane and landing on a horse, but he could have been remembering those women who stole his watches, I guess. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.